The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America.
This lecture entitled The Luminaries of Mechuza, The Life and Times of Rav Nachman and Rava, is dedicated to the merit and honor of the Goldenberg family.
It is hard to believe that the country of Iraq, an impoverished and troubled land, now devoid of Jews, was once Jewry's leading intellectual center. During the time of the formation of the Talmud, the greatest minds of Jewry from across the civilized world gathered together in cities that no longer exist to ponder questions and decide issues of thought and practice. Their discussions and ideas recorded in the Talmud have lived long after them and have occupied the minds of the world's greatest thinkers ever since. The cities of Sura and Pumbedisa, the subject of previous lectures, although no longer in existence, held a prominent place amongst Talmudic scholars for hundreds of years after the completion of the Talmud. There was one center of Jewry, however, whose influence shone like a meteor, casting a bright and striking light throughout the skies, only to dim and to finally completely fade. This was the city of Mechuza, home to such luminaries as Rabbi Bar Abua, Rav Nachman, and finally Rava. It was in Rava's days that Mechuza reached its zenith. In the year 338, after the death of Abaye, the subject of it was covered slightly in the previous lecture, the site of the Masifta moved from Pumbedisa to Mechuza under the direction of Rava. Because of the persecution instituted by the church in the land of Israel, in the land of Babel, Christianity really did not strike roots, or to any great extent. The great scholarship that produced the Talmud Yerushalmi and its scholars came to an end, and ever-increasing numbers of rabbis from Israel moved to Babylon. So we had, in a time when Rava became the head of the yeshiva, and before him Abaye, there was this whole move from Israel to Babylon. So not only did you have the local scholars, those who were originally from Babylon, but you had those who emigrated because of the tremendous pressures. Rava's Masifta and Mechuza was in practical terms the Sanhedrin, the central rabbinic body for all of Jewry. There was no Sanhedrin, so to speak, no Masifta in Israel at the time because of the persecution. Those scholars that remained really remained undercover and had a very low profile. So it was only in Babylon were they able to thrive. It would be akin, this is a fascinating story. There was a scholar who wrote a commentary on the Talmud Yerushalmi, on the most difficult to understand of the two Talmuds, the Talmud that was produced in Israel. And he wrote this commentary while he was an accountant in Russia. And he smuggled it out. He was a scholar who could really, he had very few people, if any, to discuss his ideas and his thoughts. But he wrote it down and smuggled it out. There's probably a certain parallel to that, to what was happening in Israel then. There were still scholars, they were studying, but they had a very low profile. Babylon was a place where it flourished, and those that could get out and to leave Israel to go to Babylon did. According to the historian Revisa Kalevi, it was in this Masifta, the Masifta of Mechuza, under Rava, that much of the Talmud Bavli took its final form. But the light of Mechuza illuminated the world for a relatively short time. Soon after Rava's death in the year 352, Mechuza faded from history with relatively little mention or influence. The life and times of the great personalities of Mechuza and the indelible imprint that they left for all eternity is the subject of tonight's lecture. The city of Mechuza is first mentioned in connection with an event that destroyed one of the major Torah centers of Babylon, and in its wake caused the creation of many others. This event is described by Rav Shmuel Gaon in his classic letter as follows. And if you have the handouts, it's on the first page in paragraph A. In the year 259 CE, Papa Bar Netzer came and destroyed Nahar Dor. Papa Bar Netzer is the Judaic form of the king of Palmyra. Palmyra was a major kingdom on the crossroads, on the major travel route in northern Syria. It was the people, the locals, were actually Arabs, and they aligned themselves with Rome because it was still part of the Roman. It fell in their influence, and even though it's quasi-independent, it was still basically a Roman city. And with the support of the Romans, the Palmyrans waged war against the Persians. Persians and the Romans were avowed enemies. Rome would have liked to have stretched its claws, its influence, to Mesopotamia and beyond. In fact, in the time of Trajan, in the year 116, they were successful. But they couldn't hold it. They retreated. And from that time on, Mesopotamia was not Roman. It was originally under the Parthians and then under the Persians. Papa Bar Netzer waged war against Persia. Nahar Dor is mentioned in the Talmud, as Gemara in Erevin and Mem Hei in 45a, as being a major city on the boundary. It was Al Asaper. It was a boundary city. It was therefore a fortified city, and it was very important that it never fall. This is a comment that the Talmud makes. In the year 259, it fell. And as a result, because of the destruction that the Palmyrans wrought, the population, those who survived, were forced to flee. And the letter continues, "Thereupon my ancestor, Rabba Bar Abua," this is Rav Shmuel Gaon, the last of the Gaonim who wrote this, that he had a tradition in his family that he was a descendant of Rabba Bar Abua. "And he went to Shachnitziv and to Shalchi and to Mechuza." He would only travel from one city to the next, finally settling in Mechuza. Rav Yosef Bar Chama, the father of Rava, was there at the time. Rav Yosef Bar Chama is mentioned in the Talmud as a great scholar. Our other rabbis went to Pumpedisa. We had mentioned before, this is the last lecture, about Pumpedisa, how it became a center of Torah under Rav Yehuda. Here we have, in this brief paragraph, we have a reason why it would have seemed, I mean logically, that after the death of Shmuel, that Nahar Dor would have remained a major center, and eventually a mesifta, this would have come out, the yeshiva would have come in Nahar Dor. This was Shmuel's This was Shmuel's, this was the place of Shmuel, this was the place he created his yeshiva, his masifta. This was one of the great centers of Jewry that's mentioned, even the works of Josephus. And yet after the death of Shmuel, we find now Pumpadisa as a major center. And Pumpadisa continued to be a major center, says, really up until the 10th, 11th century of the Common Era. Rav Shriragon was the Rosh Yeshiva of Pumpadisa. This is already in the 10th century of the Common Era. What happened to Nahar Dor? Now from this period we see the reason Nahar Dor ceased to be that center is that after Nahar Dor fell to the Palmyrans, many of the other rabbis, those who were studying there, went to Pumpadisa, which was nearby. And this is why Rav Yehuda really made roots in Pumpadisa, created his yeshiva, and once it was there, it was there. Rabba Bar Abua, and it's interesting just to note what kind of a person he was. We know, there are two things we know, the three things that we know about the personality of Rabba Bar Abua. This was the ancestor of Rav Shriragon, the first of the three great rabbis that we're going to discuss, who were the rabbis of Mechuza. Rabba Bar Abua was a Talmud, was a disciple of Rav. It doesn't seem that he was a close disciple of Shmuel, even though we find him in Nahar Dor, Shmuel's city. All the quotes that we have in the Talmud of Rabba Bar Abua are from Rav, who is the Rosh Yeshiva of Sura. And he is mentioned often. And as we're going to see, generally quoted by his chief disciple, Rav Nachman. You know, as we're going to see, you know, everything, there's a statement in the Zohar, in Parshas Noso, Hakol Tzrichan Mazel, everything needs mazel, needs good fortune. Afilu Sefer Torah Shebehechel, even the Sefer Torah that's in the Oron HaKodesh, in the Ark, needs mazel. There are many great people, many great scholars in the world, people who had tremendous insights, much to offer. But they didn't have disciples. And all their ideas, therefore, never preserved. There are the others who wrote Svarim, or published. They're Svarim that gather dust. Why some people are fortunate not only to make themselves people worthy of teaching, but that are fortunate enough that their ideas and insights survive after them, seems to be a mazel, to be part of the great plan that we don't understand. Rabba Bar Abua merited a great disciple. This is Rav Nachman, which we're going to discuss soon. And it was through Rav Nachman Rabba Bar Abua lived for all time. Rabba Bar Abua, in addition to being a disciple of Rav and a teacher of Rav Nachman, was also the Rav, the rabbi of Mechuza. And we find his name in conjunction with Mechuza in terms of rulings that he made for the city. He was the rabbi of the city. We quote one of these rulings here on paragraph C of the first page in terms of the laws of Erev. And the laws of Erev very often are very complicated, and he made a ruling, actually, that in Mechuza, actually, there was no one central Erev that combined the whole city, but actually different neighborhoods had their own Erev. This was because of a decision he made. But there's a third part of him that I'd like to discuss. Now, as we've discussed, not only his greatness in Torah, being a disciple of Rav, teacher of Rav Nachman, the fact is that he had the responsibility as the spiritual leader of Mechuza, But he was one of those people mentioned in the Talmud in conjunction with Eliyahu HaNovi, Elijah the prophet. It's interesting, in the secular world, the world generally, the world of great intellectual achievement is separate from the world of a mystic experience. We generally think of mystics or righteous people as not necessarily intellectual giants. Their greatness lied in their spirituality. Others, great intellectuals, were often very, very far removed from spiritual greatness. In the Talmud, we often find that the concrete examples that greatness in Torah, great intellectual achievement in Torah, goes hand in hand with great spiritual achievement. They're not separate. It's interesting, even those that were known primarily for their tzidkus, for their righteousness, for their spirituality, we do find casual mention in the Talmud of their great intellectual achievements. Choni Hamagol, who was known as the great person who, you know, there was a time of drought, there was no rain, there was a time when the temple was still standing. Josephus mentions him, in fact. He stood and he made a circle around himself. He says, "I'm not leaving this circle until it rains." And God made it rain. The story is told only in conjunction with his righteousness. With this fact is the kind of pull that he had in heaven. But yet in another passage, they speak of his great learning. That in the Beis Medrash they used to in the place of learning they would quote his rulings in the Talmud. Here we find in Rabba Bar Abu again we find this close connection with the world of spirit and the world of intellect. And he was one of those who mentioned the Talmud of the great teachers. Who spoke to Eliyahu HaNavi, Elijah the prophet, according to the Talmud, and again this is quoted quite often in the names of the greatest teachers of the Talmud, that Eliyahu HaNavi, really as we see from Scripture, never died. He came, he left with his body and went to the spiritual world. It says, he comes down. And it's often quoted in the Talmud, says, conversations that he had with the great luminaries of the Mishnah or the Talmud. I quote for you, it looks as on paragraph D. We have in paragraph E a fascinating conversation he had with them. After a Talmudic discussion about various issues, about bankruptcy, about the laws of brachos, and they happened to be in a graveyard of non-Jews. And he said, Rabba Bar Abua said to Eliyahu HaNavi, you know, aren't you a Kohen? It was a tradition that Eliyahu HaNavi was a Kohen. He said, what are you doing in a graveyard? And he told him, and he explained to, based on the opinion of Shimon Bar Yochai, that the laws of, even though a Kohen is not allowed to come have direct contact with the dead body, nor move a dead body, however, if he is standing over a dead body of a non-Jew, he is not affected by tumah, by this spiritual impurity. And that's the opinion of Rishim Bar Yochai, and that's the opinion that he quoted. And then Eliyahu HaNavi asked him, says, you should have known this. You know? I mean, it's not in the Mishnah, but it's in a Braisa. It's in the enlarged version of the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition. Why didn't you know this? And he answered, says, the reason is, listen, you know, it's I have to make a living. And I don't have that much time to learn. And then this, it's one has to know if this is to be taken literally or it's only an allegory, but it's a fascinating story in any case. Because again, when we deal with the following passages, it's really hard to know what passages are meant to be taken literally and what passages are just originally meant to be only an allegory. But this is how it reads. He led them into paradise. He took them to Gan Eden and said to them, remove thy robe and collect and take away some of these leaves. So he gathered them and carried them off. As he was coming out, he heard a remark, who would so consume his portion in the world to come as Rabba Barabua has done? You're taking from that world. He says, you can't take. Thereupon he scattered and threw them away. Yet even so, since he carried them in his robe, it absorbed their fragrance, and he sold the robe for 12,000 denarii, which he distributed amongst his sons-in-law. But no, he also had the problem of supporting sons-in-law and Kolo. One thing we know, and again, it's hard to know what's to be taken literally and what's only allegorical. But one thing is clear, and this is the Marsha made the point. Evidently, he was given wealth, but he didn't want to have pleasure from that wealth. It wasn't something he earned himself, and therefore, as he distributed it to his sons-in-law, and it would seem that he didn't have sons, at least at that time, to give it to. But he had married daughters, and he gave it to them. But he personally didn't want to have pleasure indirectly from his portion of the world to come, which is in itself is tells us much. The Jewish view is that we look at the world as really a place of opportunity, a place of growth. But this is not the place to get reward. The value of what we're doing is too great. And the spiritual reward is too great to be repaid in this world. And evidently he didn't want to touch it. He didn't want to have anything from it. It was given to him. I feel I shouldn't throw it away. He made others have pleasure from it. But he didn't want in any way to feel that he's eating up his portion, which is just a fascinating, the moral is tremendous. Now, very often, we think, things are difficult. Why can't I have more? This person has more and that person has more. Why can't I have it too? And the traditional viewpoint, the view of the Talmud is this: there's much in store for you, but this is not, it's not payday yet. This is not. And in fact, those that are paid as a true payment are only paid because this is the only currency that these people will take. In other words, a person who is a spiritual person, and whose reward will be all the great mitzvahs that he's done in this world, that he will really appreciate in the spiritual world. Such a person can't be repaid. It's just too coarse. You can't repay a person. There are other people, though, that have no place in that world, in the spiritual world, and they have to be repaid. So their payment is really something that they could understand. It would be akin, and we've through the classes we've told this mushal, this analogy before. Imagine, if you wish, that that unbeknownst to a mother, says the child goes through the patio door, a little child who's just crawling, goes through the patio door, goes out in the patio to where the swimming pool is, goes to the edge and falls. Before the mother realizes what has happened, she hears the splash. She goes out. She's fallen in the deep part of the water. The mother, in a state of shock, can't swim. She can't do anything. She's just screaming terribly. A neighbor hears her screams, jumps over the fence, dives into the pool fully clothed, takes the child out who has already stopped breathing, administers artificial respiration, brings life to that child. The person who did this saved the life of the child, saved the sanity of the mother, probably saved the marriage. All of these. And finally, says the mother, after everything calms down and the child is already laughing and is come, so says, "I have no way to pay you. Can I give you a candy bar?" I mean, there's no payment. There's nothing on this world to repay someone who did all of this. There's no currency. There's no money. You can't pay them. In that sense, a mitzvah, every mitzvah that's done, is really too great to be repaid in anything that exists here in this world. But unfortunately, those who have no portion in the next world, who are not part of that next world, have to be given something. It's not right. And they're given candy bars, vacation homes, swimming pools, honors, whatever it is, that's a currency that they could. In fact, it is a fascinating story that's brought in the Talmud with Rabbi Akiva. There's a Gemara in Sanhedrin where he saw his Rebbe, Rabbi Eliezer, who had just had some sort of a loss to his wine. It's a tremendous amount of money, and he was besides himself. And Rabbi Akiva was happy, and Rabbi Eliezer asked him, "Well, how can you be happy now?" And he said, "You know, up until now, I saw everything you did went well. You were successful in all your ventures, and I got to thinking, you know, it's a little funny. It's a little too successful. Maybe this is what Hashem is giving him his payment in this world, and maybe for some hidden reason that's beyond him, Rabbi Eliezer has no portion in the next world, and that's why he's being paid in this world. When I finally saw things weren't going well for you, I thought, ah, then you know, you're not just getting your payment here in this world. You have payment for the next world, too. These are just like fringe benefits." But it's just this idea that really what we're doing is really too important to be paid here. In fact, the Rambam says all the reward that we get in this world is really not reward, because we can't be repaid. It's like the candy bar. It's just a means to keep on doing what we're doing. Because when you live in poverty, you know, you can't just, the story, I didn't learn it because I'm too busy making a living. Says, you're helped. Says, if you're doing good things, you're relieved of other duties. You're just, as I know in this city, there was a Rebbe many years back in this city, who, because of difficulties in the yeshiva, became a fundraiser on the side. And he was so good being a fundraiser, they relieved him of his duties as being a teacher, and he became a full-time fundraiser. If a person is just so busy trying to eke out a living, says he can't do other good things. So it's made easier for him. It would be akin to the person says, "I'm all tired out," says, "I can't jump over the other side after she'd saved the baby. You know, I'm wet and I'm tired and exhausted. You know, I need something to go back home. Here, take the candy bar." It's not a payment, it's just a means just to get back. And in that sense, that's how we look at what the dynamics of what reward is in this world. We're never really rewarded here. And if we are, we should worry. But one outstanding feature here is that here is a major teacher of the Talmud, an intellectual giant, and yet here was a person of the highest spiritual stature, who in heaven they felt he was worthy of having communication with Eliyahu HaNavi. There's another, just as it will, before we go on, just another side issue, also fascinating issue here. It seems from this passage and other passages of the Talmud as well, when Eliyahu HaNavi comes back to earth in human form, he is bound by all the mitzvahs of the Torah. We deal with him as a human being, not as an angel. There are times we speak about him coming not in human form. According to the Medrash, by every bris, by every circumcision, Eliyahu HaNavi comes. He's coming in spirit, not in body. That's something else. But when he comes in human form, he's a human, and he's bound by human laws. And it's fascinating. Some years ago, in Israel, they wanted to reinstitute a Sanhedrin. And the basis for reinstituting the Sanhedrin was based on an opinion of the Rambam. Because the Rambam maintained that the order, as we know from the Talmud, the Sanhedrin were all appointees of people that were in themselves appointed, who were appointed all the way back to Moshe Rabbeinu, to Moses. As Moses created the first Sanhedrin, and they in turn made the future appointments. When it stopped, though, when the Sanhedrin came to an end, and this is probably the time of Rava, when already the scholars ceased the function in Israel. There's no more smicha. How will there ever be a Sanhedrin again? And the Rambam, based on this, posits that there must be an alternate way of creating a Sanhedrin. And he says if all the scholars of Israel come together and make those appointments, they are bound. They are binding. So we can there's an alternate method of creating the smicha, the ordination, the appointments of judges, is through the meeting and decision of all the sages of the land of Israel. This is how the Rambam rules. And as a result, in the 16th century of the Common Era, in Sfas, there was a beginning of reinstitution. In Safed, there was a reinstitution of the smicha. Rav Yosef Karo, the author of the Shulchan Aruch, was one of those who received this smicha. But it was not continued. And partially was based on opposition from the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. And part of the argument against the Rambam, the argument against this, is that we cannot posit a new means of creating smicha. There won't be any new means. So it's really the old way. And if you ask the question, but everyone who has had previous appointments have already died out. So who is going to continue the appointment process? And the answer is Eliyahu HaNavi. Because Eliyahu HaNavi was part of the Messiah of Torah. He's part of the transmission, the tradition of Torah. And the Rambam counts him, the Rambam beginning of the Yad HaChazaka of his work, counts him as one of the great teachers of Torah. And he will come back. And when he comes back, he will make the appointments. Because when he comes back in human form, he is a human. So this is just not, besides just being an Agadata Gemara, just to say, you know, it's just part of the what we call the non-halachic part of the Talmud. Though we do learn from this and from other similar sections, what would seem to be a very important principle. And it really has a bearing. Then, if we're not forced to, there's no reason to assume there's an alternate means of creating a Sanhedrin. The Rambam only said this is because there was no other choice. There had to be. Those who argue with him says, we have another means. Eliyahu HaNavi. Elijah the prophet will be the one to reinstitute the smicha. Rabbah Bar Avua, according to Rashur Agon, was a part, as we say here on page 2, on paragraph A, section 2, was a part of the princely house, the house of the Resh Galusa. As we've explained in a previous lecture, the position of Resh Galusa was the equivalent of the Jewish king. They were descendants of David HaMelech, of King David. Rabba Bar Abua was of that family, even though it's clear he was not himself a Resh Galusa. He wasn't. He didn't have that position. There is a whole question, and again, historians grapple with this. Rav Nachman, who would seem succeeded Rabba Bar Abua as rabbi in Mechuzah, was married to a woman from that family. And as a result, it seems he had tremendous power. He was the chief, it would seem, the dayan, the chief judge of the house of the Resh Galusa. And as a result, as we're going to see, he got tremendous experience and is known in the Talmud as the expert in civil law. We also know, and this is on top of page 3, that Rabba Bar Abua was considering taking Rav Nachman as a son-in-law. Rav Nachman, the question is, was that he was a, Rav Nachman was very late in physical maturity, and he was not sure if there was a hormonal misbalance in Rav Nachman. As he was a student of his, he didn't have a beard, he was very late in maturing. He wanted to see if he had other signs of maturation. He was considering taking him as a son-in-law. The Talmud does not say that actually he did. And there is a question, therefore, as we know that Rav Nachman is the son-in-law, you know, is of the house of the Exilarch. Does it refer that he married Rabba Bar Abua's daughter, or perhaps it refers that actually he married the daughter of the true Resh Galusa, somebody else entirely? Again, this is a subject which historians grapple with. We do know, as we said, this is on page 3 in paragraph D, taken from a Gemara in Beitza, in Be'ah, and Chofei Yom HaBeis in 25b, that Yalta, who was Rav Nachman's wife, was treated with the royalty, you know, that was with the treatment that was due those from the house of the Exilarch. This, the carried in the sedan chair was only people which the community needed, people of power. And it was for the, and it was important for them to go from one place to the other for the good of the Jewish community. They allow them to do this on Yom Tov, even though it has the appearance, going in this kind of a chair, of going on a trip for, you know, a very long trip, which has its uvda d'chol, has the appearance of you doing something which is not in keeping with Yom Tov. But they did make an allowance for this law. Yalta, Rav Nachman's wife, made use of this allowance, which would seem again that she was a woman of power. And there are those who claim, therefore, she was the daughter of Rabba Bar Abua, even though it's not all that clear. Even though he was from that family, doesn't seem, though, that he actually was part of the ruling class. He left there, he went to Mechuzah. But this is, I just want to share with you, this is an open historical question. But one thing is certain, Rav Nachman, who seems to be the chief disciple of Rabba Bar Abua, eventually returned to Nahar Dor. This is the place, the original seat, which was destroyed by Palmyra. He returned there, and it seems also that the Resh Galusa, the seat of the Exilarch, returned to Nahar Dor, rebuilt Nahar Dor. And he was, it seems, its chief judge. And the Talmud deals with Rav Nachman, as we said before, as the expert. At the end here we quote, on the end of page, in the bottom of page 3, referring to a certain ruling that he made. This is 3 lines from the bottom. I, in Shavur HaMalko, this is King Shapur, this is a reference to Shmuel, who was the greatest expert in civil law, are like brothers in respect of civil law. And he refers to that he had attained this level in his lifetime. And it was recognized by his colleagues on the top of page 4, Rav Huna, a subject of a previous lecture, who was the head of the Masifta and Surah, referred to him as the expert. In other words, and really deferred to him. They had an argument about a certain question. And Rav Nachman asked him, says, in practical law, who do we rule like? And Rav Huna said, we rule like you, because you are the greatest expert. Says, you have continual access to the gate of the exilarch, where the judges are in session. You're constantly involved, not just in teaching, but in practical civil judgments. And therefore, through that, you've attained greater expertise. And the ruling is, whenever Rav Nachman disagrees with a colleague of his, there's a Gemara Ksubas, and you give him a Amud Aleph, we rule like Rav Nachman as it relates to civil law. Rav Nachman, though, even though he returned to Nahar Dor, still did not sever his connections to Mechuzah. And as we quote from the letter of Rav Shmuel Gaon, Rav Nachman was in Shalchi and Mechuzah together with the rabbis of Nahar Dor, those that fled. We don't find Rav Nachman coming in front of Rav Huna as a disciple, rather their relationship was as colleagues. It seems that Rav Huna was older than Rav Nachman, but their relationship was that of colleagues. And again, we're speaking about Mazel. Rav Huna was the great Rosh Yeshiva. He was the head of the Yeshiva of Surah. We spoke of the thousands of disciples that he had. Rav Nachman was a dayan. He was the head of a court. He was a rav, a rabbi. He didn't have great, it doesn't seem he had a great yeshiva and thousands of students. But the people that he touched, and especially Rava, went on to touch others. And just like Rabba Bar Abua, left Nahar Dor, went to the hinterland, went to Mechuzah, and he was able to have a student, Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman, in turn, even though he wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva in the same standing as Rav Huna or Rav Yehuda, in the previous lecture in Pompadisa, he wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva. He was by and large a Rav. He was a rabbi. But yet he still managed to have a small group of disciples. And Rav Nachman, as a result, is mentioned throughout the Talmud, even though you would normally think a person like that would rarely be mentioned. I mean, after all, he doesn't have thousands of disciples. But he was recognized for his greatness by his colleagues, and therefore he was quoted by them. And in discussions in the yeshiva, he was widely quoted, and he was quoted by his disciples. I would just like to end off this section of Rav Nachman, and again, just to summarize, we don't know exactly who his father-in-law was. Perhaps he had several. It's not clear in his lifetime. But we do know that his wife was related to the Reish Galusa, to the head of the exile, and as a result, he had a special position within the ranks of the Reish Galusa. His place was Nahar Dor, and as a result of being a judge, he became in his lifetime the greatest expert in civil law. He did not have a yeshiva as his other colleagues of similar stature, of Huna, Rav Yehuda, but he had tremendous influence. And again, we find him not only as an intellectual giant, but again as a saint. And here, this is a few a few vignettes, you know, of his life, just a sense of what kind of a person was he. Rav Nachman, fascinating. Rav Nachman would honor old people. This is taken from a passage in the Talmud in Kedushin Lamed Gimel Lamed Aleph in 33a. He would honor older people, but he would send his servants to honor them, to escort them. He himself would not stop learning. He didn't stop his learning from it. And he made this statement. He says, if it wouldn't be for the Torah, how many Rav Nachmans like myself would be in the marketplace? The only reason I'm somebody is from because of the Torah. He says, how could I stop learning? You know, just an interesting notion of what he viewed as, if the Torah makes me, how could I stop learning? You know, there's a fascinating parallel to this on the flip side of the coin. There was this is a story around the turn of the century. There were several great yeshivas in Europe, in Lithuania and Russia. One of them was the yeshiva of Navarduk. And the Rosh Yeshiva was of Yosef Yoizel Horvitz, and who this Yeshiva of Navarduk eventually made many branches, some 70 branches they had in Poland before World War II. But this story goes before World War I. And there was a certain man of wealth who gave enormous amounts to the Yeshiva of Navarduk, but almost nothing to any other yeshiva. And he was once asked by one of the Rosh Yeshivas, says, why is it that you give so much money to the other yeshiva and almost none to ours? We also have an important place, and we're also doing important things. So he explained to him, when you come to my mansion and you see the exquisite furniture, you see the white, plush, rug, with the high pile. You take off your boots, make sure not to get dirty the rug. You sit at the edge of the couch, and treat me with the greatest of respect. I'm not a great Torah scholar. I learned when I was a bacher, when I was a young man. I learned in yeshiva, and now I'm in the world of business. What do you respect me for? It's not for my great saintliness. It's not for my Torah. It's, what do I have? It's because of my money. And if I give you any of it, I'll have less. When the Rosh Yeshiva Navarda comes to my house, he treats me like a Yeshiva Bachar 14. He walks in straight with his boots, makes himself at home, speaks to me like I'm 14. And I look around, says, what did all this money do for me? Nothing. Take it all. You want to take it as much as you want. Rav Nachman looked at his Torah. That's what made me. If that's what makes us, how can I give up? How can I not use every minute to make myself even greater? Very interesting, we find this very often with Rava, Rav Nachman's disciple. When he realized he was wrong, he said openly in public, I made a mistake. It takes a lot of courage. You know, there are many great stories of Rosh Yeshivas in the middle of their lecture. They're asked a question that they really can't answer. So some, go back and forth, It's like there's one particular story of a great rabbi who was giving a lecture, and he was asked a question from the audience that he did not know the answer. So he looks straight at that person. He says, a person doesn't know his left hand from his right hand, so from links to rechts, should go ask me such a question? He says, it's a explicit passage from a Gemara in Moed Katan, says in Hei Omed Aleph in 5a, says, how could you, you forgot that Gemara, how could you ask me this question? And he kept on after that remark,
and finished his lecture. So afterwards, the young fellow who asked the question came to the Rav who gave the shiur, and he says, "I looked at that Gemara. I don't see says how it has any bearing on this question." So the rabbi explained to him, the Gemara in Moed Katan quotes a pasuk, and this is V'som derech yira b'yesh elokim, one who places his path, and chooses the right path, will see in the salvation of God. Al tikre v'som, a shin is written without a dot, and the shin could be read with like a sin. And if it's written as a sin, the dot is on the left side. Or it could be read as a shin, and then the dot is on the right side. It says, Al tikre v'som, one who chooses a path. El v'shom, shom is a language of valuation. One has to always evaluate his path. You always have to check it. Because whatever you're doing, you always don't assume you've been doing this before, it says that it's good now. You always have to check and recheck. And the Gemara quotes as an example of this, that a person always has to be in tune with the time. It says, Rabbi Yanai had a student who, when they were studied privately, used to riddle him, used to ask the most difficult questions. But when Rabbi Yanai used to speak in public, that student was silent because he didn't want to embarrass his Rebbe. It wasn't just v'som derech, he's placed the path to permanently go on, but v'shom derech, a person is always evaluating. Says, there are times yes and at times no. That student of Rabbi Yanai knew there were times to ask and times not to ask. Says, and that's what I meant to you. You don't know between your right and your left. You don't know where to put the dot of v'som. Says, you put it v'som, which is the left side. Really, it should be v'shom, the right side. You should have evaluated when is the right time to ask a question, and like the student of Rabbi Yanai, not to embarrass me in public. And that's a Gemara in Moed Katan and Hey Omed Aleph in 5a. So he says, a person doesn't know between his right and left should ask me a question like that? You forgot you forgot something which is an obvious passage of the Talmud. And that's the way he pushed him aside. It's a nice way of saving face. There are other incidents, though, of Rosh Yeshivas who've been asked questions. Realizing the difficulty of their position, just closed the Gemara and walked down, off the... That takes an awful lot of courage. They say one fierce fighter, when it came to learning, was the founder of the yeshiva in Lakewood, Rav Aaron Kotler. And he would fight bitterly anyone who asked him a question in the middle of his shiur, in the middle of his lecture. One story goes, he was lecturing in Israel, in Yeshiva Eitz Chaim. And he was attempting to resolve a very difficult passage of the Rambam, of Maimonides. And he gave in a brilliant and ingenious resolution to a difficult problem. And there was someone in the audience who kept on asking him, it doesn't work out, your answer doesn't work out because of this reason, of that reason, the other reason. And they kept on sparring back and forth. Finally, Rav Aaron Kotler lost total patience for the person. He says, out. Just get out of here. You're not letting me continue. Just get out of here. So the person rose. He went to the back door. And before he left, he turned around and he says, I'm leaving, but that Rambam's still shver. It's still not answered that he left. Rav Nachman, when he found that he made a mistake, said in public, I'm not saying the Rabbi made a mistake, but I'm just saying that there's different approaches to this. He says, I made a mistake. He said it publicly. He referred to himself, which is an interesting passage. The Gemara says there was a statement in the Talmud, the end of Sota, that after the death of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, a whole era had ended. And humility and fear of sin came to an end. No man will ever reach the level of having true humility or having true fear of sin. And Rav Nachman said regarding himself, Nachman said to the teacher, the one who taught this, he says, this is an error. He says, because this don't include fear of sin that ceased with the death of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, because there is I. Says, I have it. Evidently said others have it too. You know, it's not, I know that it hasn't come to an end. And therefore, says, evidently he felt, once you say something came to an end, no one can strive for it. Like, it's all over. Says, evidently says, a little person like me also has it. Other people could have it too. But it gives you a sense of what a kind of, what a person he was. Because again, the intellect, with spirituality, says, in terms of Talmudic teachers, went hand in hand. Before Rav Nachman died, Rava was seated by his bedside. Again, Rava was his close disciple. And he had a deathbed vision. It was before he died, and he saw the Malach HaMavos. He saw the angel of death. And he told Rava, says, tell the Malach HaMavos, says, to make it easy, not to torture me. So he says, he wouldn't do anything like that to you. He says, you're a person he respects. You know, you're the Godel Hador. So he says, you know what? When it comes time for me to go, no one's esteemed. You know, when he comes, the Malach HaMavos comes, he doesn't respect anyone. So he says, Rava asked Rav Nachman, before you go, says, please, he told him before he died, please come back to me in a dream. Tell me how it was. And the Talmud relates, evidently this is what Rava told his students. Rav Nachman came back to him and told him, he says, the pain was slight. He didn't feel pain when he left. He says, but I wouldn't want to come back onto this earth again, you know, to relive the death process, because I was just so scared. Seeing the whole thing, he says, like this, I wouldn't want to go through that fear. Which is an amazing story. As I said before, Rav Nachman's great student was Rava. In the top of page 6, the Talmud, and this is, we quoted this last week, the Talmud describes various leaders who died, but before they died, Hashem had prepared a replacement for them in this world. Before Rabbi Akiva died, Rabbi was born. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi was born. Was already alive. Before Rabbi Yehuda Anasi died, Rav Yehuda, the subject of the last lecture, was alive. When Rabbi Yehuda died, Rava had already been born. And Rava would seem to be, was considered the successor in this line of great leaders. And he was a very unusual person. It seems, and this seems to be the Rambam's opinion as well, that this passage, Rava was born, doesn't mean he was just an infant when Rabbi Yehuda died. In fact, Rava, it seems, had already was a mature adult. He hadn't come into his own yet. But he... we know Abaye, his colleague, was born in the year 278. If you take a look in the timeline, just a sense of who lived and when they died. Abaye died, and this is next to the bottom thing, in the year 338. That's when he died. He lived to be 60. So he was born then in the year 278. Abaye, when Rav Yehuda died, this is the year 299, was 21 years old. Rava was his close colleague. We don't have any hard figures when Rava was born, but it would seem that roughly they were of the same age. We know as well, says, there are certain passages that we find Rava speaking to Rav Yehuda, also speaking to the elders of Pumpadisa, as a Gemara in Psochem, says in Kuf Yud Zayin Amud Beis, 117b. The elders of Pumpadisa, as we quote here in paragraph E, were Rav Yehuda and Rav Eina, but Rav Yehuda was one of them. He was a son-in-law, it would seem after the death, but he was a son-in-law of Rav Chisda, which we mentioned in a previous lecture. And he also seems to have studied under Rav Chisda. But his chief this Rebbe was Rav Nachman. But like others of the time, even though they had a chief Rebbe, after Rav Nachman was in Mechuzah, but because of their love of Torah, they traveled elsewhere. As we're going to see an interesting incident here, he studied with Rav Sheshes, who also seems to have been, was in Mechuzah. And he studied with Rav Yosef. In page 7, paragraph J, when Rava was about to take leave of Rav Yosef, he would go backwards so that his feet were bruised and the threshold of Rav Yosef was stained with blood. He hit himself. The people told Rav Yosef was blind, that Rava did that, whereupon he said to him, "May it be the will of God that you raise your head above the whole city." In other words, you've lowered yourself. You've humbled yourself in front of me, because in that schus, in that merit, you will rise one day. And as Rav Shura Gaon quotes, he says, his bracha was fulfilled that eventually Rava became the head of the Masifta. Rava became the chief scholar, chief sage of all of Jewry. In terms of the years, we find is a fascinating story here at the end of page 7. Not only did Rava study with the feet of Rav Yosef, but Rava's son also studied with Rav Yosef. And in fact, when his son got married, they made up that his son would study under Rav Yosef for 6 years and not come home. In other words, he would leave home and stay there for 6 years. And when he came home a little early, after 3 years, his father was very angry with him. But again, it gives you a sense of you know, how old he was. This is a proof the Rav Isaac HaLevi brings. If we would take the passage of the Talmud literally, that Rava was born when Rav Yehuda died, that would mean, this is at the time Rav Yosef died, Rava was just 24 years old. And it's a little strange that he had a son who learned by him, who had already been there for 3 years. So he says, and this is that really the passage is to be understood, and this is the opinion of the Rambam, that he already had been born and been, you know, had been already a scholar before Rav Yehuda died. Before we go on to Rava, I'd like to touch upon the city of Mechuzah and to share with you, this is a phenomenon that happened not just here at this time. One of the greatest centers of Torah in the 19th century was the Yeshiva of Volozhin. It was founded in the early part of the century by Rav Chaim of Volozhin. It had some of the most illustrious scholars of the world taught in the Yeshiva of Volozhin. But because of the pressure that was placed upon it by the Russian government, it was forced to close. And those who were involved in the yeshiva looked at it. This is probably the greatest tragedy that ever happened to Jewry. You know, one of the greatest tragedies, short of course the mass expulsion or mass extermination that had happened. But this was the great center of Torah, and it came to an end. The Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Toli Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, was so heartbroken that within the year he died. And it seems from all accounts as because of the trauma had such a terrible effect on his health. But yet, because the yeshiva Voloshin closed, its students were forced to go out, and they created yeshivas throughout Russia and Lithuania. And what seemed to be the greatest curse turned out to be the greatest blessing. We started the lecture with the destruction of Nahar Dor. Nahar Dor was the city. It has a history of hundreds and hundreds of years. It was the place where Shmuel had his yeshiva, his mesifta. And at the time it was overrun and people were forced to flee to Pumbedisa. It was terrible. So it was a terrible tragedy. But because of it, because they were forced to flee, new centers of Torah arose. Who knows if Nahar Dor had not been destroyed and Rabba Bar Abua wasn't forced to go to Mechuza and to take his disciple with him, Rav Nachman, who knows if Rava, who was a local product of Mechuza, his father was a Rav of Mechuza, who knows if he would have ever developed to be the shining star. Mechuza was very different city than the other cities of Babylon. The cities we've described before, Nahar Dor, Pumbedisa, Sura, were near the Euphrates. And that seems to have been the essential Jewish settlement. Mechuza was by the Tigris. And Rava, who was the Rav of Mechuza, describes the peculiarities of the city. Here we can't go, the time isn't allowed to go through this, is all of this material, you can look at yourself. Evidently he felt that the waters of the Tigris had an effect on the people. It seems to have been a large city. The laws of Rishus HaRabim, of a public domain, apply to it. According to many opinions, you need 600,000 people to qualify to be Rishus HaRabim. And if that's the case, then Mechuza was a city of such tremendous proportion. Also, I say uniquely, from those of the rest of Babylon, there were a large number of converts in Mechuza. And Mechuza was very wealthy. Listen, they always had Babylon seemed to have been cursed with poverty. Mechuza was outside of the pale. He says, Ravina once come on page 9, we have, once came to the city of Mechuza, and the housewives of Mechuza came and threw before him chains and bracelets, which he accepted from them. Evidently he was collecting money for a cause. And Rabba Tosvah said to Ravina, was at the end of the period of the Talmud. Was it not taught charity collectors may accept from them small donations but not large amounts from the women because the husbands may object? And he said, these things are considered with the people of Mechuza small amounts. They're wealthy people. What seems to others is large amounts. So these people are small. The people of Mechuza had stone floors, which seems to be unique. In Babylon, they had dirt floors. That may be royalty. People of Mechuza had stone floors. And they were wealthy, and the women did not work. In fact, Rava, you know, made the point here in page 9, paragraph F. The women of Mechuza says, you know, they don't work all week, but they don't work on Erev Shabbos as well. So, you know, so there's something good to be said. It says at least, you know, when it comes close to Shabbos, they you know, they stop working early because they don't have really much to do. The people of Mechuza were delicate. I mean, they were very well pampered, even though it seems there was a working class. But the people, by and large, were pampered. And for these people, evidently, again, as fate had it, because Nardol was destroyed, and Rabbi Barabbur was forced to go to Mechuza, and because of that, Rava grew to be such an illustrious person. It seems he had a tremendous effect on the people. At least he attempted to have an effect on the people. These were not an easy group to work with. And at one point, and he dealt with them, evidently he felt the best way to deal with them is on one hand to criticize them, and on the other hand to try to, with a soft touch, to bring them out. He makes one statement here. He says about the people of Mechuza, these are people, evidently he felt that they're not productive people, and they're going to, they call them B'nai Gehenim. Says the most handsome people of Mechuza, says they belong to Gehenim, says the nether world. They're not doing anything with their lives. And he would criticize them. On the other hand, he would say, this is on the bottom of page 10. Rava said to the townspeople of Mechuza, based on a previous statement, honor your wives that you may become enriched. In other words, evidently he couldn't appeal to them to honor your wives because that's the right thing to do. So he had to go work around the other way. He says they valued money. He knew how to press the right button. The Talmud makes the statement, says that whatever a person loses throughout the year is bashert. In other words, it's already decided from the beginning of the year, in the judgment of Rosh Hashanah, how much money a person is going to lose. But it's not decided how he's going to lose that money. If he gives that money to charity, so that's the equivalent of having it lost. If he doesn't give it to charity, the government will come and take it. Well, the accountant's here. Rava told the people of Mechuza, how did he get them to give tzedakah? How did he get them to give? And again, the direct approach he knew won't work. So he worked a roundabout approach. I beg you, it's at the top of page 11. This is more above a Basra in 9a and Tessamah. I beg you, hasten to the assistance of one another so you may be on good terms with the government. And I guess because of his unique approach, you know, on one hand he criticized them, but the other hand he saw their weaknesses and tried to use it as a fulcrum, so to speak, as a means of getting them. Knows they know, you know, they don't want problems with the government, so they told him to give tzedakah. They want wealth, says honor your wives. Abaye made the statement of a scholar's love by the townspeople. He's not doing a good job. A rov should be one to, you know, the people should be unhappy with him because he tells them things they don't want to hear. You know, there's a very famous statement that Yisrael Salanter said, a rav that the community does not want to get rid of is not a rav. He's just not doing his job as a rabbi. If they succeed in getting rid of him, he's not a mensch. In other words, he's lacking those special skills of diplomacy that he can't, you know, save his position. Rava, though, it seems that at first I thought all the people of Mechuza loved me. When I was appointed judge, I thought that some of them would hate me and others would love me. Having observed, however, that the man who loses today wins tomorrow, they kept on coming for judgments. You know, so you win some, you lose some. So either I came to the conclusion that if I'm loved, they love me all. If I'm hated, they must all hate me. But there's no particular reason, you know, because of the judgments, because they all, you know, they all win some and lose some. No one has a feeling that I favor any one of them. But why should he think that he's beloved? You know, Abai says it's not a good sign to you. It could well be because he felt he knew how to deal with his people. After he was a product of Mechuza. He came from there. And even though he criticized them severely, he knew how to deal with them. And again, you can look at the notes. We're going to conclude soon. It says he had not only did he have an ability to deal with his own people, but he had a special relationship with the queen mother, the mother of the king Shapur. And King Shapur was no great friend of the Jews, but because of the influence that he exerted on the queen mother. Evidently, says the relations between the Jews and the Persians were much better than they would have otherwise been. As a person, we find, says that he was, in relationship to the other great leaders of Jewry. Because after the death of Abaye, as we said in the year, in the year 338, Rava became the head of the Masifta. And this is in his lifetime. That Masifta moved from Pumpadisa. He did not want to leave his flock in Mechuza. I mean, he could have left and gone to Pumpadisa. It wasn't his city. He wanted to bring Torah to Mechuza. And the Masifta, the yeshiva, all came to his city. And for 14 years, he not only was the Rav of Mechuza, but he was the Rosh Yeshiva as well. To give a sense of what kind of a person he is, and I'll give two vignettes here. One is a statement of his on page 14, paragraph B. Rava said, I made three requests of heaven. Two were granted me, one was not. This is Gemara Moed Katan in Chof Ches Omad Aleph in 28a. I prayed for the wisdom, the scholarship of Rav Huna. I prayed for the wealth of Rav Chisda. And those both were granted me. But for the humility, the modest disposition of Rava Bar Rav Huna, I prayed, but it was not granted me. Evidently, he felt that in his greatness, he wanted even to be more humble than he really was. And if we find him as a humble person who, like Rav Nachman, when he felt he made a mistake, admitted his error. The Hasidic movement, which was founded by Rishol, says Baal Shem Tov, took in it one of the principles of their faith was a statement that Rava made. Probably that above all tells us what kind of a person Rava was. Rava, again, as we said, says had the wisdom of Rav Huna, was blessed with wealth. He had a difficult time when he was a young man. He lost children and wives, and he lived in poverty. But he eventually rose to be the chief scholar amongst the Jews, and as Rav Isaac Halevi points out, there was in his yeshiva in Mechuza that the Talmud took much of its form. But he made the statement that the importance of life, importance of the measure of a person, is not his scholarship. This is on the top of page 15. Because the Holy One, blessed be He, requires the heart. It says, Rachmana Liba Boy. God wants one's heart, one's wants sincerity. There were other great, there were great scholars in history. There was Doeg, Achitofel, great scholars, geniuses, but it doesn't count. That's what he said in the first and the bold. Is there any greatness in propounding problems? greatness, is how Rava defined it, is greatness of the heart. And probably of all the great legacies that were left to us by Rava, because there are hundreds and hundreds of statements in the Talmud by Rava, but this probably ranks as one of the greatest. We went through this year, we went through the great scholars in Israel, the great scholars in Babylon. In the next lecture, we'll deal with the life of Rav Ashi, who in his lifetime, the Talmud took its basic final form. And the Talmud that we know, 95% of it, was created at the time of Rav Ashi. So his life will be the subject of the next lecture.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.